Hello and welcome to Epochs number 105. I am joined by Dan.
Hi.
And last time we talked all about financial bubbles, didn't we? We talked about the original one, the Tulip Mania. So I thought we could do the biggest bubble of all time, the Wall Street Crash.
Okay,
the
sounds
Great Crash of 1929, because I'm fascinated by that. It's sort of one of the first places you go if you're interested in financial markets and the history of money and all that sort of thing. It really is the biggest one of all time. And it also, there are lessons to
certainly an impact there, on society. I mean, of course, the numbers are bigger these days. And probably the number of people affected these days is also larger because of the network effects that they have now. But certainly the cultural impact and the long shadow it casts. Because, I mean, I know the history to a certain extent, but you're going to be much, much better on the history. But what I'm certainly aware of is the long shadow that it casts. So there's a lot of regulations and thinking that came out of the response to that, which still overhangs today, which I'm sure we can talk about as well. So, but yeah, certainly a huge cultural impact.
Yeah, because, well, there's not a direct, well, there's the Great Depression of the 1930s, sort of so-called lost decade of the 1930s. And people argue about how much the Wall Street crash played into that, because the low resolution version is everything was absolutely fine. The Wall Street crash happened in October 29, which caused the Great Depression, and that's it.
I don't agree with that.
Yeah, but so it's much, much more complicated than that.
But there is going to be an element of, I think this is something you mentioned to me earlier, which is the confidence element. That was certainly going to be a factor in it.
And it is part of it, for sure. It's not like the Great Crash had nothing to do with the Great Depression, but there's just a bit more to it than that. But it is the biggest bubble, just a huge bubble. So just to put it in some context, just to talk about it, set it up before we go into some of the details and the aftermath and everything.
Yeah, I mean, last time we spoke, we talked about a whole number of these. And the one thing that they've all got in common with each other is that leverage effect, where basically times were good. There was a genuine seed of something underneath it. So last time we talked about the Tulip Mania. Now, and in that society, because it was such a button-down sort of religious society, there wasn't really many ways you could express yourself apart from buying tulips to have a nice front garden. So it was a genuine something there, and then it got out of hand. And basically all of these, including this one, they start off with that. And the Roaring Twenties is probably the best backdrop to this, because it was a period of genuine economic expansion. They'd had a whole bunch of new technology come in, which was revolutionising the way they worked. So things like the motor car and the train was established at this point, but telecommunications were starting to roll out, the telephone, radio, all of these things. So there was that genuine economic expansion that was happening. So you did have this this real period of a really good 1920s, and then people just extrapolated from that. Okay, well, the good times are never going to end. And also, because I can bank on it, I can, instead of buying whatever securities, I can just go out and borrow twice as much money and shove it all in, and it starts to get completely out of hand. And it's just the same as all of those other bubbles we talked about last time. It's good times leads to people getting a little bit crazy about how they respond to this.
Yeah, I think a lot of financial bubbles, like wars, they've got lots of commonalities. But also each one is a unique thing as well.
Yeah, same but different, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. So you touched on a fair few things there. Absolutely right, the idea of sort of the Roaring Twenties. Certainly for America.
Yeah.
This the idea of almost a blind optimism. Just an optimistic time. People said that they thought it was just like a permanent prosperity.
And it must have seemed that way, because, I mean, if you suddenly get those things that I've talked about, I mean, electricity, again, is a little bit earlier, but it's really starting to, because like with the internet, you know, we got it in like whatever it was, the 90s, but it wasn't really until the late 2000s or really into the 2000s when it really got going. And that's because we have sort of faster adoption cycles these days. But back then, you know, things like electricity and trains were really getting up to speed, but then you've got the motor car as well, and you've got those telecommunications. So you can see from their point of view, it must have seemed like there was this huge sort of expansion of economic potential. And actually, again, the other parallel I draw is I'm seeing a lot of parallels with that today, because we're getting AI, we're getting robotics, we're getting genomics, we're getting a whole bunch of other technologies that are coming together at the moment, which could potentially recreate some of these characteristics, providing we can get past the nonsense that we're going through at the moment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It seemed very optimistic, certainly for Americans. To put some context on it, I've heard it said that from sort of the 1870s through to the 1890s, lots of things occurred, lots of inventions, should we say, occurred, which we just completely take for granted now. Things like the light bulb.
Yeah.
So by the late 20s, that had already been around for, you know, sort of knocking 40, 50 years. And yeah, the automobile, we take cars absolutely for granted.
The other factor with that, things like you say, like the light bulb, but when you first had the light bulb, they were really expensive. It was a rich man's toy. It was a novelty. But what happens with these things is you get that mass production effect and eventually the cost comes down so that everybody has it. Now you think about how that must change your life.
I'm talking about the Edison light bulb, for example, where, where normal people could buy one. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. So when it becomes mainstream and it will revolutionize your life. I mean, you imagine living before that. I mean, candles are really expensive. So a lot of people, when it got right, they just went to bed. But how that changes your life, that you can sort of sit up and you can socialize and you can read or do whatever you want to do after that. So again, you're right, we take it for granted, but what it must have seemed like to those people at the time must have been extraordinary.
Just a quick note on candles. Just things in the past that we just don't really do much anymore, like writing letters and having to have loads of candles. And whether you have really cheap, crappy tallow candles or you've got a small collection of good candles. Yeah. But candles were a big thing, obviously. But we just forget all of that now. It's just all forgotten. Like, there's no need to...
I mean, my house has loads of candles, but they're all the scented nonsense.
Right, so. Really expensive ones, scented ones, yeah. But yeah, so by the 20s... in America, anyway, there had been some sort of explosion of commodities. So, like, the radio had come out, and all sorts of things, like having a fridge. Again, things we just take
absolutely... Oh, they had fridges back then. I didn't appreciate that.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, air conditioning. Like, air conditioning was quite new. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, we still don't have that in Britain, but I know the Americans love it.
Yeah. just lots and lots of commodities. There was, again, a bit of an explosion of just inventions. The idea that, like, what will they come out with next? Like, that was sort of a saying from the 20s. And you couldn't believe that there'll be this new...
Yeah, and I think we're back in that as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, there is a good parallel with today.
It goes to show the importance of drawing the right lessons from history, because everything is a cycle. You know, you get that period of expansion, speculation, the bubble effects, and then you sort of have a crash as the irrational exuberance dissipates on the other side. So it's important to be able to draw these lessons that we're getting from this, so that as we start to go into this whole cycle again, you know, we are I think for us the 2030s are going to be similar to the 1920s in that respect. So again, it's really important for us to learn the right lessons from the past, so that, you know, as we sort of go into this again, especially all the younger people watching who are you know, going to be at the forefront of some of this, you know, don't think that this time in history is unique, because it, you know, same but different.
Absolutely. I'm going to say stuff about that a bit later on, that although the Wall Street crash is unique in some senses, it's in lots of other ways far from unique. There were lots and lots of things that happened before. I mean, we touched on it, I think, last time we spoke, that all throughout the late 19th century, there were loads of bubbles and crashes on the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
Because just to mention, it's the New York Stock Exchange still. It's the Dow Jones we're talking about here, even though it's 1929.
Well, the dollar was the crypto of the time. I mean, it wasn't a cryptocurrency, but it was very new. It was getting that adoption. It was very expansionary. People were coming into it. People were doing some of the same silly behavior that they're doing with crypto at the moment. But it didn't have all the sort of safeguards and rails. So when it fell off, it really did fall off. And so you got that sort of huge drawdown. So which we're getting at the moment as well with crypto. It is a similar adoption cycle, just 100 years earlier.
So here's something I want to say, just to set it up a little bit, is that obviously they're just coming off of World War One.
Yes.
And one of the things, the country that did best out of World War One, shall we say, was America, by quite some way.
Pays to be late.
Obviously, their country wasn't... There was no battlefields in America, of course, nor were there any in Britain. But
But there were lots of factories which were selling the stuff over to us.
Yeah. So a lot of the European nations, the biggest powers in the world up to that point, had gone into crazy amounts of debt in order to pay for the war. Both France and Germany, but France and Britain particularly, went into something like was going to say billion, but could it be trillion? No, it couldn't be trillion. It must be 10 billion.
In inflation adjusted, I'm sure it will be in the trillions. But yeah,
back, no, sorry, back 10 then, what billion. It, what it, yeah, it was something like 10 billion in debt to America, mainly to American banks.
And that was 10
commercial
billion.
Banks.
That was 10 billion when a billion was a real number, when it really mattered. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we're talking sort of, you know, the very, very early 1920s. We owed America a fantastic amount. And I've even heard it said that on some level, the sort of the wealth of an empire was transferred from London to New York in order to pay for World War One.
Yeah.
And also the Germans, after the 1919 Versailles Treaty, had to pay reparations again to, I think, the tune of billions, 30 billion or something in dollars.
Yeah.
I think it was like 6 billion.
Whatever it was, it was absurd. It was well beyond their capacity to pay.
I think it was something like 6.6 like gold marks or something, and that worked out to something like $33 billion. Yeah. Anyway, they basically were borrowing that from America to pay to Britain and France mainly. And we were paying off our war debts to America with that money. So round and round it goes.
I mean, you say round and round, mostly to America. But
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But you can see how those two bites of the cherry, the First World War and the Second World War, because the same dynamic sort of played out on both of those. Well, I mean, less with the reparations, but you can see how there would have been a trend anyway of global hegemony from the UK, well, Britain, to America anyway. But those two big events, they just sort of really kicked it along massively.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to say this as just to cast shade on the United States, because I don't really do that. I'm a fan of the United States, if anything.
I like the ones with the big hats. Not the New York ones.
yeah, not all of them. But, you know, I'm half American myself. I've mentioned a number of times my dad is an American, born and raised in Oregon. But they were war profiteers. They couldn't help it, really. It's not like they designed it
that
way. Well,
they still are.
But, they made lots and lots of wealth out of both the world wars. But, again, it wasn't like a moustache twirling grand plan.
Just what they do.
That's just the way it sort of had to be, in a way.
To be fair, Britain did exactly the same thing in earlier periods whenever there was a continental war. You know, just fund both sides of it, why not?
So by the 20s, America was in a great position. They'd gone from being quite a small power in the late 19th century, relatively, to arguably the biggest power, certainly completely competing with the British Empire, with the Russian Empire. The Russian Empire was gone by, or the Soviet Union, with the biggest powers in the world. The United States by the 20s had emerged as one of the world's biggest powers, absolutely, like, you know, easily. The dollar was sort of king by that point. It'd become one of the most important currencies easily. And their industrial output was giant. And their country was absolutely infused with optimism to the point where sort of the Calvin Coolidge administrations all throughout the 1920s, there was sort of a 9-year bull market where
he was one of the good ones, wasn't he, Calvin Coolidge?
Depends what you want to say. He was later found out to be an inside trader,
right?
That's
small cheese by today's standards, though.
He was actually quite good. I mean, there's a story of when he was first got the news that he was going to be president, he just knelt down and prayed. So that was the sort of man he was, you know, quite a fairly religious guy. He wasn't a...
They don't even pretend to be religious these days.
He wasn't a crazy womanizer like Jack Kennedy or anything like that. So all throughout the 20s, like I say, this sort of a very strong sort of bull market, everyone thought that prices would just keep going up. They would say things like... There's world markets now, and the whole world want American commodities.
Actually, that's another interesting thing as well. Yeah, that
will never end.
The globalization effect. So Europe had been, I think it took until something like 1998 for the world to become as globalized as it was before the First World War. And that was sort of, you know, Europe was trading with each other sort of very, well, very fluidly before the First World War. And that kind of went away after the First World War. But actually, yeah, you're right. For the Americans, it was different. It didn't. It actually accelerated, because instead of those trade flows happening within Europe and some of the other sort of established economies, instead it started to be a flow from the US. They were sort of the China of their day. Mm. You know, they were producing the manufacturing goods and sort of shipping it out to everybody.
Because that's not a liar or anything to say there's a world market and everyone wanted American goods. That's not a liar.
Yeah.
But the problem is that they thought, well, that will never end. That will there's constant growth there forever.
Yeah.
And, well, that's obviously just wrong. It's not possible, is it?
That gets us into why people thought, okay, instead of buying stocks, I'm going to buy stocks with leverage. So instead of, you know, I've got $50 available to go and buy stock in whatever company it is that's going up all the time anyway, why don't I just leverage that with my broker? So I go to my broker and I say, okay, I want to buy $100 worth of stock. Here's $50. And I'm going to do it on leverage. I'm going to owe you that much. And you then get twice the upside from that point forward. And then everybody starts doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's shoeshine boys are on leverage. Mm-hmm. And it just sets us up for... And you can see that what that starts to do is it starts to hugely expand the amount of money that's going into the markets, but not all of it is real. Probably less than half of it is real money. The rest of it is just leverage. And the thing is, with leverage, it could just disappear the moment sentiment turns.
I mean, you're actually underplaying it a bit there. It's actually more like you could buy on margin at 10%.
Oh, right.
So 90% of it is you're borrowing.
I didn't know how much it was. I mean, I know that...
You can buy at 10%.
I know that all bubbles throughout history, they always come down to leverage. But yeah, so if it's 90%, that's huge.
I want to talk a little bit about that in a little minute when I come on to that. Just want to set up a few things before. But just quickly to say on that, and this is a good life lesson for anyone out there, never gamble with money that's not yours. It's just never, ever do that. And if you speculate in, I was going to say securities, but any speculation really,
it's really
gambling. It's a type of gambling. Yeah. Okay, you're taking a risk.
Yeah.
Don't ever gamble with money you can't afford to lose. It's as simple as that. Don't put a knife in a toaster that's on.
For the vast majority of people.
Just don't ever do that, right?
For the vast majority of people, the only leverage they should ever really use is for their house and maybe a car, but it should probably stop there. Having said that, people who get very rich tend to use leverage very smart, but it really is a double-edged sword. It can come back to you. So you really need to know what you're doing. I mean, I use it as little as possible because I know how dangerous it is.
Yeah, actual professional traders will have stop limits and things.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, you...
Yeah.
I honestly think the idea of gambling with money you can't afford to lose, it is as stupid as... like dropping an electrical item in the bath with you. It's like it's going to be terrible.
80%
for you.
Of the job
you're
of the trader is risk management. It's not actually doing the trading.
I also in a minute want to make a sharp distinction between traders and brokers. I've got a very dim view of brokers. I'll tell you all about that in a minute. But just one quick thing just to hammer the point home about confidence and optimism before the crash.
Yeah.
Earlier that year, 1929, in March, Herbert Hoover, President Hoover, had won.
Okay.
And he was being inaugurated.
So it was Coolidge and then Hoover, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And Hoover hadn't, it's funny, sometimes this is the way, he'd never run any big business or never been a senator or a congressman before. One of the things that gets said is that the business of America is business.
Right.
You know? The idea that you get, there's like giant families like the Carnegies or the Rockefellers or the Vanderbilts. And we'll get into some of these a bit later, actually. You're going to mention some of them a bit later. But when Herbert Hoover got in his inauguration, the speech he made at his inauguration is the hubris in it is sort of, it's very, very thick because it's later that year. It's in the autumn of that year. The great crash happens, and what he says just shows that he had no idea, or probably had no idea. Some historians and scholars have later said that him and the people around him probably did have an idea. They were deliberately trying to be as optimistic as possible because they realized that confidence in and of itself is a massive thing, and it's a bit of a house of cards. And as long as people have confidence, that's sort of more important.
That's pretty much what they do now. So I can well believe it was exactly the same. I mean, the common theme here is going to be investor psychology or people psychology or the psychology of the people that works in the market. Well, a quick aside, one of the best books in investing to read is, I think it's a book called Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. And that was written around about this time, sort of in the early 1900s. You might think, okay, well, how is that relevant to me reading a book about somebody who was a trader over 100 years ago? And the reason it's relevant, because actually the book is mainly talking about the psychology of humans.
Right.
And that does not change from decade to decade or century to century. Mm. Again, it goes back to my point. It's so important to understand these past historical events, to understand the world that you're currently in, because, yeah, okay, the events will be different, but human psychology, that has not received a firmware update in the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Greed and fear and panic, they're universal, aren't they? Yeah. But the irony in Hoover's words is inauguration, the hubris. I mean, he said this, quote, "We have reached a higher degree of comfort and security than ever existed before in the history of the world. Through liberation from widespread poverty, we have reached a higher degree of individual freedom than ever before. In no nation are the institutions of progress more advanced. In no nations are the fruits of accomplishments more secure. In no nation is the government more worthy of respect. No country more loved by its people. I have an abiding faith in their capacity, integrity, and higher purpose. I have no fears for the future of our country. It is bright with hope."
I kind of like that.
It's a lovely sentiment.
Yeah.
But the irony of it, because, you know, I have no fears for the future. Well, there's a Great Depression coming.
Yeah.
Like next year, basically.
Yeah.
Bright with hope. Well, that hope was sort of rubbed out in October that year in some senses. Because just to touch on it now, although I want to talk about it later towards the end, the Great Depression was, I mean, it really was that. Lots and lots of people... Millions of people it crushed. They ended up with mass unemployment.
That's something like
25% of America was unemployed. That's like 12, maybe 13 million people.
I mean, I know this is going to be
the families ruined.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know this is going to be a more extreme example, but I always remember those photos of people basically offering to give up their children or to sell their children because they just couldn't afford them anymore. They couldn't afford to feed them. Mm. So, yeah, grueling times.
People that used to be middle class or certainly wouldn't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from. Now they do. Whole migrations out to California, heading out California way, you know, just to escape the poverty, the misery, almost the starvation levels in sort of middle America. And the psychological damage that it did to families, certainly men back in those days, that needed to have been the breadwinner, and suddenly they can't, and it sort of destroys them emotionally and stuff. I mean, the Great Depression really, really was terrible.
Yeah, and you make just a quick aside again on the psychology of it. Of course, bear in mind that the people who were growing up during this period were the parents of the boomers. So you got that privation mindset of, you know, we have to scrimp and save and don't use any debt and, you know, always be planning for the future, and how that then might have affected the psychology of their children who would have rebelled against that to be much more, you know, live for me, that kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, it's a good point, actually. Yeah, it's a really good point. But the words there of Hoover, it is bright with hope. I mean, it couldn't have been more wrong, really. Right, so what happened then? Well, I want to talk a bit all about confidence then, the psychology of that, because to boil it down, it's quite a fairly low resolution, but it's also true to say that people who have looked back at this, many, many great economists look back on it and they don't agree. They don't really know exactly why confidence absolutely imploded at the end of October 1929. So it wasn't that they had no idea it was coming. Most economists were sort of naively optimistic, but there were one or two voices. There's a Roger Babson. There were one or two voices that said, oh no, this is an inflated bubble market on securities. We're talking just about securities here, because there are all sorts of markets, you know, commodities markets and financial forex exchanges, the foreign exchange, you know, buying and selling, trading in money itself. But we're talking mainly about securities. So, you know, stock in companies, basically. There were a few voices saying, you know, the securities markets are massively inflated. It's gone up sort of 900% since 1921. You know, you can have bull markets, but this is sort of crazy. It's got to burst. But that was like one or two voices, basically. Nearly everyone was saying, no, it's going to go on forever.
Yeah. You always get them. I mean, I can think, I mean, the most recent sort of downturn that we've had, you know, we had really strong times in sort of 2020 and 2021 where the market was riding high. And then towards the end of 2021, it sort of fell off a cliff. And I remember hearing so many live debates about, okay, some people saying, okay, well, it's going to continue to go up. And some people saying, no, it's going to crash hard because there's too much leverage. So you always get that in sort of any time. There's always people on both sides of things. Mm. The point I'd make on this is the other thing to bear in mind, as I'm sure you'll cover, is the time scale. Because we always think of, you know, the Wall Street crash being like a day, an event. Mm. But actually, this did play out over several months. Mm. And so there were warning signs. Now, as to the inflection point, actually, if I can do a quick plug for Brokenomics I've recently
Please
done.
Please do, yeah.
It will probably come out after this goes out. But I did one on the film Margin Call. And that was all about in 2008, about very similar thing. The markets have been going up for, you know, like a decade, and people thought, okay, this is brilliant. This is never going to end. We can leverage into this. And that film is all about basically one night in investment bank when they realize, oh damn, this is out of control. We really need to turn this around. And the actions that they go through, and the moment that it does sort of turn for them, and that bank then becomes a seller. And I analyze that film in that Brokenomics. So watch out for that one when that comes out. But it would have been a similar sort of thing with this, is there would have been people who would have been, who, you know, everybody, what's that saying? Everybody goes mad together and then comes to their senses one by one. It would have been a bit like that. Mm. More and more people would be like, okay, now I'm going to sell into this rising market. And then at some point that just tips over the top. And that is why I think, I mean, I haven't studied this, but yeah. I know investor psychology, so I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
Yeah, there was one particular day. It's the 24th of October. Is right. They call Black Thursday.
Yes.
But I'll get onto that just in one sec, because to say before that happened, there had been, I mentioned earlier, that there had been a fair few market crashes, full blown market bubbles, securities bubbles that had crashed in the 19th century. There was a big panic on the Dow in 1907. Where J.P. Morgan himself, the original James Pierpont Morgan himself, went down and sort of stabilised the market personally, just bought loads and loads of stocks, and it worked.
Yeah, and that plays in here as well, doesn't it? Because they try and copy him later on.
Right, yeah, exactly that. Because they saw what J.P. Morgan had done, and they thought, maybe we can do that.
So that was at the scale. First of all, he had enough wealth. And the markets were small enough one man was able to come in and essentially reflate it. Essentially, it's not quantitative easing, but it's a similar thought process of he's going to inject enough liquidity into it to get it going again.
Just to restore confidence in everyone else. You know, you don't have to actually buy all the markets or anything. Just be
seen to have a bid out there and buying. Yeah.
Just to help with the confidence side for everyone else. Mm. So in 1907, JP Morgan had done that. Then in September 1929, there had been a crash on the London Stock Exchange. And that's like a month before this. There'd been a fairly bad crash, not quite as bad as the Wall Street crash, but there had been a crash, and it affected New York, and markets prices had taken a tumble, and securities had taken a tumble.
As we talk about this, I'm just seeing parallels all the time with, I keep saying it, these things just keep playing out. So our modern analogy for that is we've just had the US banking crisis, which isn't over. I mean, that's continuing to rumble in the background. I think it's going to turn into a commercial property crash fairly soon. But the London version of that is that we had the, do you remember under Liz Truss, where everybody tried to blame it on Liz Truss, but it was the pension crisis that happened a few months earlier. Exactly the same dynamic. It's like you get a warning sign there. The first canary in the mine dies. And people think, oh, that's bad. Oh, but whatever, just carry on.
Yeah.
And it's same mechanisms you're talking about here.
Yeah, that definitely happened, where people are like, wait, what's going on? Oh, everything's okay, fine, I'll just carry on.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.